Those who were here last week, all last week, may know or may remember that I called this series of Cabbages and Kings, and that this title, this rather odd title, is derived from the very odd work of Lewis Carroll from Alice in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass, which I very dearly love. And this quotation comes from the verse here, "The time has come, the walrus said, to talk of many things, of shoes and ships and ceiling walks, of cabbages and kings, and why the sea's boiling hot, and whether pigs have wings." So I quoted from these lines, "The Cabbages and Kings," and I talked last week about religion, that is, first about the meaning of words, which to me seems quite important that we know what means of communication we use, what words can convey and what words cannot convey. I am firmly convinced that the very deepest truth about religion cannot possibly convey by words, and certainly not by written words, so this of course can be argued. And then I talked about symbols, which is again an important prerequisite to me for the understanding of scriptures, and then I boldly because I'm a layman, totally untrained and untutored, plunged into religion by speaking about the Trinity, speaking about prayer, speaking about miracles with some fear and trepidation, which I had never done before, and then steering to the somewhat calmer waters of Christian art, and yesterday we had Rembrandt. And now I turn to engineering, and in my systematic way, which you may consider definitely pedantic, before I go into the engineering subjects, I want to talk about what physicists and engineers are. The title is "Physicists and Engineers, What Are They?" Now, I leave it up to you to categorize this. Is this cabbages or is this kings? To me, the kings is the religion, and what I am doing now, though I'm very proud of my profession, are cabbages. But I'm sure that many people, not here in Holden, but certainly down in the flatlands, which will consider religion just as much cabbage, and will consider technology king, you see? So that's a scale of value which may differ depending on the altitude in which you are. We are at here 3,205 feet, here we are even a little higher, and so we consider kings as religion. Okay, but now I want to talk about the other part of my series, which starts today with physicists and engineers, what are they? Tomorrow I plan to talk about the story of aluminum, which means I want to tell about when aluminum came into being. Certainly it is not mentioned in the Bible for very good reasons, while the other metals are, many of the other metals are, and what it does today and how it is produced and what is made of it, because I worked with Kaiser Aluminum for 12 years until my retirement. And then the next lecture, the day after tomorrow, will be electric power in the Pacific Northwest, and that's a subject in which I, as an electrical engineer, am naturally very much interested. The area is unique in the United States, and to some extent unique in the entire world, because it's enormous. Amount of energy which is produced and consumed here is 98% hydropower, water power, and this is quite something, and I want to talk about that. And then on Saturday, that's the day when I leave, I still will give a final lecture on fundamentals of mono and stereo, because I assume that many of you have record players and buy records, and it may be of some interest to you, maybe not, but it may be of some interest to know how the sound is put on a disc, first how it was done during the past decades when we had only monaural sound, and how binaural sound is being put on the disc, with using just one stylus, but to have two speakers bringing sounds from different directions. Okay, so that's my plan. So today, again, physicists and engineers, what are they? And I will start with physicists. Physics, of course, historically has undergone tremendous changes in the past century and this century. When I went to school, which was quite some time ago, we still had the division into mechanics, light, sound, heat, and electricity and magnetism. These were all disciplines, part of physics, and they were taught in school under these headings which I just gave. Under mechanics we had static, and we had the dynamics. That is, static are the relations between forces, say acting on a roof or acting on a bridge. So these are already engineering points. You see, the physicist is not concerned with roofs. He is interested with a, quote, mass point, a massen point. That is, he has a mass, but he assumes that the mass is ideally concentrated in one point, and then he investigates what forces act on this point and how are these forces interrelated to other points. You see, he sets down the laws which govern these relations. And this is just as well true for light, where we have reflection and refraction and these things, and for sound, where we have sound waves and all these things which have been taught empirically. And the way the technology developed, of course, it was more and more possible to penetrate into the secrets of nature and to unlock them. And the same is true, of course, of heat, which came as a science into being rather late, you see, because the first steam engine was not built until 1700 and something, you see. So that's, in the history of man, of course, a fairly short span. And then this was done empirically, and the laws which governed the operation of such monsters were enunciated, well, certainly somewhat later, basic laws of thermodynamics. And electricity, well, while lightning had always existed as long as the Earth exists, certainly as long as we have an atmosphere on the Earth, and man has always realized that this was a certain typical phenomenon, and it was also known even in the Greek times that if you took Bernstein, what is this? This yellow stuff which is found at the shores of the Baltic, which is being used as jewelry, and Bernstein as well, that's a rosin from some tree. If you rub that, then of course, and it attracts paper particles, and these effects, frictional electricity, were even known to the Greek. But electricity as a science of physics, as well as magnetism as a science of physics, did not come into being in the time of Enlightenment in the 18th century. Now, all these various disciplines of physics dealt with nature under a certain aspect, namely to put order in it, to formulate what is commonly called laws of phenomena which were observed. You observed that an apple fell down at a certain speed, and that the speed increased continuously, and by making some measurements, the law could be enunciated which governs the falling of an apple, or the law of the reflection of light, or the law of heat transfer, and all these things. And physicists were, of course, all through their time of being, since the idea of a physicist came into being, originally he was just a man of science, you see, who had much interest in other disciplines. You see, physics as a distinct discipline evolved gradually through the Middle Ages, you see, when the people were interested just as much in astronomy and astrology and theology and so on. You see, the very concept of a physicist is something, again, which came into being, I would say, at the time of the Enlightenment. So these men, usually they were men at that time, were concerned with putting the phenomena which they had observed in nature into laws. And this brings up a quite important point. These laws are not immutable, they are not fixed. And this is very true up to this very moment, up to this very day. There is frequently the conception, or I should rather say the misconception, that these physical laws stand there as immutable blocks, never to be tampered with, never to be destroyed. This is completely wrong. It is completely wrong. Man, with its limited senses, has observed certain relations. You may write down this length, this time, this length, this time, this length, this time, as a long table. And finally, if you analyze the data, you may plot them on a graph paper, you will find that they follow a certain curve. And out of this, then you can derive what you call a law, that instead of having a whole table with experimental data, you can describe this phenomenon just by one equation. The mathematics are the tool, they are the working tool of the physicists. They are not a means in themselves as they are to the mathematician. To the mathematician, mathematics is everything. To the physicists, mathematics is just a tool, like to you it may be a knitting needle or a pencil or so on. It's a tool to perform certain tasks. So the physicists use mathematics as a means to express observed facts in a law, in an equation. Okay. Now, this holds true, this beautiful law holds true as long as no new observations are made which will not fit the law. Man has progressed from using his five senses to using the most refined, delicate, and terribly expensive equipment with which he searches nature. I mean, radio telescopes. You may have passed by Brewster and seen this enormous dish standing there in the landscape. You see that is to get the reflections of electromagnetic waves from the outer space, in this case from a satellite, because this is part of commercial installation. But you have such radio astronomic things in England and in this country too, just to probe the heavens, to probe radiation which comes down from the heavens. Now, okay, with such sophisticated equipment, you may detect a whole lot more than you are able with to detect with your five senses, naturally. You could take microscopes and look into the small matter, the minute matter of the universe, that you have an electron microscope where you can still go some decades lower. You get to magnifications which you have never been able to, which one, for some very definite reasons, one cannot attain with ordinary light waves. And so new secrets are unlocked. And these secrets may not obey the laws as they had been formulated up to now and accepted until now as, quote, true. They have been superseded. And that, as a consequence, new people have to formulate new laws which fit the old observed phenomena as well as those which now have been uncovered with the more sophisticated equipment. I hope I have made that clear. Now, I said, one started out with these various disciplines, mechanics, light, sound, heat, electricity, and magnetism. These are now treated under one general heading because they are all considered part of an electromagnetic concept of the universe. You see, light has a certain wavelength, and if you change your wavelengths, then you get into heat, and if you change your wavelengths, you get into electromagnetic radiation. So there's a continued transition, and these old sharply defined disciplines have now all become part of one generalized and unified a body of physical knowledge, you see. The relativity theory, of course, has vastly increased our concepts. We do not have anymore the concept of a fixed length, not even the concept of fixed times. It changes with the velocity of the body on which you are. There's one concept which is now the arch constant in the universe, and that's the velocity of light. The velocity of light does not change regardless whether you are a body which flies very fast or which stands still, and nobody stands still. All bodies have relations, motions relative to each other. So this new concept has been enunciated by Einstein first in the early 19th century in the special relativity theory, and it was then later broadened in a very fantastic way to take in phenomena such as mass and energy. Energy, now you know pretty well what that is. See, your car has certain energy, electric power plant has certain energy, and mass, something which substantially has a certain weight. It was Einstein who first enunciated, purely from the theoretical point of view, that mass and energy are basically the same, which was an utterly revolutionary idea, and he was considered a crackpot, a Jew, of course. Only Jews can have such crackpot ideas. This was at the time when the Nazis were in the ascendance, you see, and there was ridiculing and You know how his life was, that he came to this country to see as a refugee and so on. It was later, much later, that this revolutionary and totally unheard of concept was verified experimentally. And the atomic bomb is the crowning example that Mars, fissionable Mars, was really transformed into energy, into such energy that Hiroshima and Nagasaki was obliterated, and that subsequent bombs proved, atomic bombs and hydrogen bombs proved that these bombs which fell there at the closing end of World War II were just child's play. There were hundreds of thousands of people were killed in the fraction of a second. They were child's play as compared to what the atomic bombs can do now. Now, these bombs actually convert mass into energy, and they are a crowning affirmation of the laws which Einstein had enunciated several decades earlier and which were considered completely crackpot. And now we have already touched two basic divisions of the physicists, that's the people who work in the field of physics. These are the theoretical physicists and the experimental physicists. Nowadays, it seems to me hardly possible that a man has the faculties of being proficient in both fields. Either he has a natural bent to the abstract way of working, like Einstein, who never could even put in a screw with a screwdriver, but who was an absolute genius in formulating laws and taking the experimental body and from this experimental body deriving new insights, which was formulated into new abstruse mathematics, which very few people could understand to begin with, and those who understood them questioned them because of their utter novelty and apparent impossibility. Before the atomic bomb was released, Einstein's radical idea were already vindicated by what is called the redshift, which means this: if you look at distant stars, not through a telescope, but through a spectroscope. A spectroscope is an instrument which breaks up the lights into the spectral lines, into the spectral colors. You will find that the spectral lines, which are characteristic for each element, you know what an element is, the basic constituents of matter, each element is characterized by specific lines in a spectrum. If you take sodium, for instance, and make it to glow, you see, then it will radiate a very distinctive line, the sodium line, bright yellow line in the spectrum. These lines shift on the spectrum if the star recedes or if the star advances. And this was an experimental proof of Einstein. The shift was very, very, very minute, but it was discovered before the Second World War, and this was a signal vindication of Einstein's law. So many people, for racial reasons, said, all nonsense, this man is a Jew, how can he have such ideas? What this means to the minds of the so-called educated Europeans is another matter, which has nothing to do with our subject. So we have then the theoretical physics, of whom Einstein was one of the outstanding examples, and we have experimental physics, that these are people who, like I myself, I'm an engineer, like to fool with machinery, with apparatus, you see. That's, of course, very, very nice. Some things you can buy from the houses which make such equipment, but much you have to build yourself, much you have to devise yourself. And while in the old times you did these things with the ceiling walks and strings and glassware, nowadays, of course, you have the most sophisticated atom smashing machines, which cost millions of dollars at the sea. Government-supported research organizations and government-owned, government-run physics laboratories which can indulge in such expensive equipment. Now, as I said, Einstein predicted this redshift in the spectral lines, and this was then afterwards vindicated experimentally. This, of course, is a unique possibility that an outstanding head goes beyond experimental evidence. Normally, you have the experimental data, and they are then formulated into laws by these theoretical boys, you see. But every once in a while, an outstanding physicist, an outstanding theoretical physicist, can make predictions. And then it's up to the experimentalist to find out whether he was true. Now, such things have happened repeatedly in the field of astronomy. The motions of the stars, which have always interested man since he had eyes to see them, the heavenly bodies, these motions were formulated in the late closing decades of Middle Ages by Kepler, by Galileo, and by Newton, you see. And these laws that describe the ellipses with which the planets moved around the sun, and the whole sun system was part of a greater galaxy, and so on, you see. Now, in dealing with the solar system, where the sun, this enormous body, stands at the center of the much, much, much smaller planets, the Mercury and Venus and the Earth, we with our first moon, and then Mars with several moons, and the other stars farther out with still more moons, and Saturn even with the ring, they were very closely investigated, and their orbits, their paths were very closely scrutinized. And it was then found that there were certain very small irregularities which pointed to the, not only to the possibility, but to the, almost to the certainty that there were other planets beyond the what was then known as the range of planets circling around the sun. Now, this was a prediction made based on certain experimental irregularities which were experimentally observed by the astronomers. And then there came people, there came theoretical people, they said, all right, if there is a star which we haven't seen yet, another planet, an outer planet, it must be at distances place at distances time. So lo and behold, the people took their telescopes, pointed it to a place in the sky, and sure enough, there was a star, a planet which they had never seen before, which again was predicted from the experimental evidence of irregularities, but which had never been seen. So this is, I don't know, do you call this an achievement of the experimentalist because they noted the minute deviations, or do you call this an achievement of the theoretic boys who then from these experimentally observed data calculated and predicted that this new unknown star X, which was then called Neptune, and the same story repeated then a few decades later with Pluto, which was another planet, was still farther out. Whether this is an achievement of the theoretical boys, this, you can argue this point.
Pluto was just accidentally discovered, wasn't predicted.
Wasn't he?
I don't believe so.
I don't know. Well, certainly Neptune was found by this Pluto. I don't know. You see, that's outside of my field. Good that you correct me. I don't want to spread here a truth. I thought both of them were predicted by it.
No, I think this guy Tombaugh in New Mexico was just taking pictures and ran across.
Just happened to run into some new planet.
Leverrier, of course, discovered Neptune right where the celestial machinations told him to look.
Yeah, okay. Well, good. You just check that I don't say anything wrong. Now, I started out by talking about these various fields of physics, the various compartments, and I said there's now a unified aspect at which you look at it. I should, of course, hasten to add that many new fields of physics have been opened up during the, say, since the beginning of the century. The atomic physics practically didn't exist at, Rontgen rays and these things, electrons, were not discovered until the last decade of last century, you see. The field of semiconductors is about 20 years old, which has an enormous importance in technology. Plasma physics, which plays quite some role and has attracted many people, is a fairly new field, and all these laser things where you have now the ordered radiation, this is a dozen years old maybe. So there are many new fields in physics which have come into being quite recently because of expanding technology and interaction, of course, between physics and engineering. So then, another point I have to make is what are the purposes of being a physicist, apart from being a physics teacher, which is quite obvious. Now, one is to be the guardian and the refiner of our units. We have units like, here we have these idiotic units like the inch and the yard and the mile. You see, in physics usually you have the metric system, you have the meter, which is the 10 millionth part of an Earth quadrant, that is the distance from pole to the equator. You take 1 millionth part of this distance measured on the periphery on the Earth, this is the meter, which is now the standard length. And for many years, this meter was exemplified by a platinum bar of the highest accuracy which man at that time could achieve during last century, which was kept in an air-conditioned vault in Sèvres, which is in the suburb of Paris, underground, and which was accurate to within, what, 1/10,000 or 1/100,000 or one, probably not 1/1 millionth part, but certainly very, very accurate. And this was the basic primary standard of length, and every civilized country, United States, of course, Germany and so on, they all had then copies of these things, and this was then the standard of length, which was quite important. And you had also the standard of mass, and you had the standard of time. The standard of time was derived naturally from the motion of the stars, one complete turn of the Earth around, that is, you saw one fixed star going through a crosshead in your telescope, and once the same star came right through again, this was 24 hours, you see. Now this was quite accurate as far as it went. But now one has changed to new standards, and one has now the atomic radiation, and specifically the radiation of cesium, which is an element, be used as the primary standard. And one has derived an atomic clock, or several atomic clocks, which are so accurate that if you would have set your time at the time of Christ, this watch, this atomic watch, would still be accurate within 1/1000th of a second. And you may say, now this is utterly ridiculous. Why do we need this fantastic accuracy? Has it any practical use? And now, again, I speak as an engineer, not as a physicist. Physicists wouldn't ask such questions. Physicists would say, well, that's fine. Let us look now for new clocks which will be still more accurate. That is what the true physicists say. But I, as an engineer, am permitted to ask purely down-to-earth question, now, is there any practical sense in such high accuracy? And the answer is yes, very definitely. Low-RAN, L-O-R-A-N, which is derived from long range. Low range is a type of a location of ships on high sea or near shore by means of electromagnetic waves. And with these low range methods, which use these extremely high accuracy, you can locate a ship, if you please, within a few feet. And this is important if a ship approaches shore in deep fog. You see, with these methods, a ship can really be eased, not by radar, as we usually consider it, by waves which are then bounced back and which delineate the shoreline. But with these long-range navigation aids, you can locate positions with a fantastic accuracy. So this is an engineering intrusion as far as this comment is concerned. So, part of the, very, very important part of the task of the physicist is to guard and to refine the basic units which we use. After all, if you buy a part of apples, somehow, somewhere, the accuracy of this scale has to be defined, and while this scale in the supermarket will not be shipped to the National Bureau of Standards for certification, this is the ultimate step, because the National Bureau of Standards, which is part of the what, Department of Commerce of the federal government, is staffed with hundreds of physicists whose purpose it is to safeguard and to refine the units. They have been in Washington, D.C. They have moved now into very nice new facilities outside, and they have a branch in Boulder, Colorado, which is chiefly concerned with radiation studies. So I have visited them several times, and this is, of course, a very, very important part of the field of physics. And similar laboratories, of course, are in all countries of the civilized world. And if there are new units, existing quantities produced with greater accuracy, then you have what we call a round-robin test, that is, such samples are intercompared between the laboratories, and one finds out what the standard of the volt of the unit of electromagnetic tension or some other standard of resistance. You see, it is not only the very basic fundamental units of length and mass and time, but they are derived units like the units of resistance, and such resistors then are shipped from one laboratory to the other between these various nations, and they are then intercompared. And they must not age, or if they are aged, then the aging must be within certain parts per million or so on, you see, or parts per billion or so on. So such work goes continuously on, and this is an important part of the work of the physicists. Now, then, where are the physicists employed? Apart from schools, they are employed in these government laboratories, like the Bureau of Standards. They are employed in university to a great extent, because nowadays universities are endowed with research work by the federal government, unfortunately mostly by the Department of Defense, that is, they do war work in plain language. And in research foundations, where more or less the same goes on, you see. And large corporations, of course, have their own physicists. A company like Kaiser Aluminum, where I was associated with, has not only metallurgists, but also chemists and physicists and even engineers. And so now we go into engineers. The major task of an engineer, as I see it, is to translate or transform or transpose the findings of the physicists to marketable products or services. Now I repeat that, because that's, I think, a fundamental definition of an engineer. An engineer takes the findings of the physicists, that is, the very rarefied results of the endeavors of the theoretical as well as of the practical physicists, the experimental physics, and he applies it into marketable products or marketable services. Whether they are to the benefit of mankind or to its detriment is the second question, which is, well, shall we discuss it? I would say an engineer like I has no moral qualms to work in my chosen and selected field to which I am very devoted. I can develop and can refine a telephone. I make it less expensive, simpler, lighter, more attractive, and above all, more efficient. Whether this telephone will be used to call a doctor to render help to somebody who had an accident, or whether this telephone is being used to by thugs to agree upon a bank robbery, this is something which is out of my field, over which I have no control. Do you agree with that? Mm-hmm. And by the same, an atomic bomb can be developed, has been developed, and while physicists like Oppenheimer have racked their brain whether this is teller, whether this is moral or immoral, I can only say this is not their business or not our business. They are physicists, I'm engineer. It is not our business, because an atom, as you know, I think you know that, can be used for destruction nowadays, for destruction of mankind, and I don't take this word into my mouth lightly, I know what I mean. The number of million people which are killed outright, the remainder of the living human race will probably have genetic changes that they become sterile, which will then mean the end of the human race. All right, so this is something which can be done. But it can be done, it is being done right now continuously, and I heard a lesson by Leo Bustert here in Holden 6 weeks ago when I just snooped around for a few days as a visitor to see what my colleagues are producing, that I fall somewhat in line and I'm not too stupid compared to them, so I want to find out what they were doing and how they were doing it. So Leo Bustert talked about the useful applications of the atom, the enormous progress it has brought forth in the field of biology, in the field of medicine. You have now isotopes with which you radiate it, which are better and more precise than if you have X-rays or other means of radiation for cancer. You have, of course, the isotopes which are given to you together with food, maybe, and then you see where these typical foods and typical things which you are fed, where they are deposited in the parts of the bone and so on. So many new insights have been produced. We have the dating by radiocarbon, you see. So this field of atomic physics, which has come into being only in the past 20 years or so, has again applications which can be lead to total extinction, and application which lead to a great benefit of the human race, as long as it's not asinine enough to blast itself away, you see. As long as it is used for beneficial purposes, that's fine. In addition to that, it can be used to blast underground caves in which natural gas can be stored, and sooner or later it will be used to blast harbors. This is still a question whether this can be done and should be done. Instead of digging and blasting with dynamite, you just loosen one atomic bomb, and maybe a new isthmus is blown out between the Atlantic and Pacific. I mean, these things are not dreams of a diseased mind, but these are distinct technical possibilities. And last but not least, we have electric energy now produced by atomic power at ever increasing rate. And to anticipate some items from my lecture of day after tomorrow, as soon as the water power, which is still abundant in this region, has come to an end, which is not only foreseeable, but is all programmed. Last unit to be put into this power station in 1975, and these units in 1978 and so on. If this is all done, then we have to turn to other source of power, and very, very likely it will all be atomic power. That is, that atom is harnessed for peaceful purposes. So, in my opinion, the physicist as well as the engineer should not concern him overly whether his work will be used to good work or to bad work. This is not his business, and I personally feel absolutely happy to work, or I was happy to work in my field, giving scant thought whether other people may make the best or the worst out of that. Now, this, of course, does not exclude my involving myself wholeheartedly into these very questions. I can and should participate in questions of civic life and in national life and all these things. I should not just sit back and fool around with my equations or with my experimental work. I am, in addition to being a physicist and in addition to being a Christian, I am also a citizen of this country. And as a consequence, I have a definite need to involve myself in these questions. I object against the idea that there are moral issues involved with your professional work and that you may stop work because it may be used immorally. I think this possibility exists all the time. And the telephone, which was developed by Bell and by Rice in the last century, quite some time ago, I don't think these people were in combat with these questions. Can the telephone be used to good or to bad purposes? Now, it's just a side issue which concerns physicists as well as engineers. And we want to return to engineers, which now I say for the third time are involved in developing the physicists' gadgets, which were made with sealing wax and strings and glassware, into marketable items, marketable products or marketable services. And in this technological age, I would be a fool to tell what has been produced by an engineer, because everything is produced by an engineer here in our life. And if the power goes off, this is just one item, you see. If the car breaks down and you have to walk down 12 miles, and then you have a boat which does not run because the diesel engine breaks down, you see. It's silly even to enlarge upon these things. Now I want to talk about the various fields in which engineering can be divided. And I do not want to talk about this at this moment, about the fields like civil and mechanical and electrical. I want to talk about something else. I want to talk about the research, the development, the manufacture, and the sales, and the specific branches. Research is, a research engineer, like I was and have been all my life, is the guy who is still closest to the physicist, because he takes right away what the physicist has produced and now gets it into the field of engineering. And he may himself have a strong bend to experiment in the laboratory which was the case with me, and as such does work which is quite akin to the work of the experimental physicists. But the definite distinction is that when he works in industry, there's somebody above him who always will say, well, that's fine, Ludwig, what, how much will we save if we do it, or how much money will it bring in? And I must be prepared to answer that. The physicist not. The physicist says, well, I have a very fine investigation, just let me finish it, give me another 100,000, and then I surely will be finished and have some nice new paper, which I present at an international congress in Istanbul. Now, not so with an engineer. The engineer is part of, in this society, I don't know how it is in Russia, but here in this society, we are under the management of people who say, how much is in it? And if I can prove there's something in it, he may loosen the purse strings. If I cannot prove it, he may very well say, okay, we give this money to manufacture, these guys need new machinery, which will produce products 10 times as fast, you just wait 5 years. What I do with this 5 years is up to me, you see. Now, it is very difficult for a researchman, for a research engineer who works on new things, to be able to tell management how much money they can save. It is almost impossible. Yes, if something is established, if something has proven, you can do it. But if you work on the forefront, if you work on new things, if you suddenly come across things which had never been considered or done, or much less manufactured, or much less marketed, then of course the situation becomes quite sticky, you see. And to make things worse, to be quite frank, of 10 new things, 10 bright new ideas, 10 bright new avenues, most promising, 9 are dead ends. 9 simply will not pan out in bringing in money. The 10th will be fine. The 10th will be a hit, right bullseye. But you don't know that where you start, because you go out in a completely uncharted field. Okay, so much about research. So all my life I was up against the question, do I get the money? Can I do it? Do I get the apparatus? Can I? Yeah, but this is all about. I say, well, you have a fine paper ready for the next meeting. Well, never mind your paper. How much money will it bring? You see, this, what's the budget? How much should we put in for Ludwig and for his gang? How much? No, we didn't make so much money last year. We cut it down. We have to cut down somewhere. Well, research, we'll cut down research first. These guys are just there to be shown around. If visitors come, they stand there in their white laboratory coat and they are very busy on complex machinery and they make a few sparks and it smells badly, so everybody sees that they work. You see, I have heard these arguments many times. I'm very well aware of them. And while this is primitive and idiotic, there is still a grain of truth in that the research people have an awfully hard part to sell themselves. Okay, now we come to development. Development is one step nearer manufacture. The development engineer is the man who takes the thing which the research engineer has built in his laboratory and which hopefully runs. It works. Then he turns it over to the development engineer, and the development engineer says, well, this part we are going to die cast, and this part can be stamped, and this part can be forged, and instead of this material, we rather take this material, and then he makes a few production samples, and they are put through the paces, and then he makes a small series of 100 pieces, which are given to people whom you know personally, for a trial, you see, and after a year or so, then they make a series of 1,000 or 10,000. And in this way, he is the intermediary, the development department is the intermediary between the research people, who are fooling around, as I just sketched it, and between the manufacturer. Manufacturer is the next step. The manufacturing plant, that is the manager of manufacture, the manufacturing of a gigantic plant which makes automobiles and so, he has to produce parts which have come down by the development department into a shape and into a material which is manufacturable. He has to see that his machinery runs smoothly, that there are no breakdowns. Now that's of course all self-understood. He has all his foremen under him and so on. He has to see that the product is turned out, that the product is up to snuff. There's always then a standards department associated with this, And I had once gone through a very interesting time in my life, so I was not personally involved in that, where this standards department, which says this thing is okay, it's fine, or this thing is not okay, was under the administrative head of the manufacturing department. And the manufacturing boss is interested by his whole make, which I understand perfectly well, to produce as much as possible. Because this is what he is for, what the department is for, that's what they get paid for. So he said to the quality department, which found out that things were not all right, he said, keep your mouth shut. And so there were products put out which had failed, which had not passed the rather rigid standards. When this came into the open, was big lawsuit, all national attraction, two men had to go to jail. The whole plant was sold by the concern because it had given a black eye, and the quality control department was from then on put under the head of an executive vice president, and they were so rigid that they leaned backwards that if anything was even approaching the point where it was questionable whether it was passing or not passing, stuff was scrapped. So they had burnt their fingers, you see? So I just mentioned that, that you have to manufacture, all right, but you have to manufacture to certain standards, to certain tolerances. If these standards are not fulfilled, then there should be an independent department which checks, and the companies boast that each Volkswagen, if you read that, you see 1,450 inspections of every car, and every 10th car is rejected, and so on. They put this in the advertising business, you see. That is very important. But if the quality department is under the manufacturing head, then there is a definite danger that there is pressure to bring the part out, turn it out, to see whether it passed or not. Oh, nobody will find out, you see. All right. So that's manufacture. It's a very important point, very important field, and I think that these men whose mental makeup is utterly different from me as a research fellow, that they have their definite place in the field of engineering. And the next group of engineers which are equally necessary are the sales engineers. These are the men who then peddle the product to the customers. Now, many things, of course, are sold well, what shall I say, over the counter in supermarkets or so. This is not think these are not the items I think of primarily. Electric bulbs, yes, you can go to safely and buy electric bulbs, 60 watts, 100 watt, three-way lamps, 100, 200, 300 watts and so on. They are all right there on the shelves, you just take them. It does not require a sales engineer for you to sell these things. But if you want to buy, say, a large piece of mining machinery, and you don't get that out of a catalog, but you don't get that out of a supermarket, then it is so that if a mine is being built somewhere, this of course in the not only in the newspaper, it most certainly is in the special publications. You see, the mining industry, mining and metallurgical industries have their special magazines, and you will find then how a company plans to develop a place there in the wilderness of the Cascades, called Holden. You see, now if this being read, then they are of course the manufacturers of mining machinery equipment, and they will run into our sound company and will say, now what type of equipment do you need, what type the manufacturer equipment, and what do you want. Now you see, that's the way where the sales engineer comes in. The sales engineer has to know exactly what his company can manufacture, what the limitations are, what they can manufacture and what they cannot manufacture. He has to know what the customer needs, and he has, in addition to that, he has to have a good deal of psychology, of course, to treat the customer correctly. If the customer wants to be dealt with on a purely engineering basis, which probably the engineering staff will do, which is called in into conference, fine. But if he deals first with the people who hold the money, that is with the purchasing agent, he has to have a different approach. He may take him out for lunch, or he may invite him to discuss this matter in Hawaii, or God knows what, you see, if it is a big thing, you see. So a sales engineer has to be a very good psychologist and know how to deal with people, but he also has to know what products the customer want and what products his outfit, which he represents, can produce. It may very well happen, and has happened many times, that the would-be client says, yes, I want this and this type of equipment. And then the sales engineer will say, very well. He will not say no. This would be, of course, totally ridiculous. He will say, very well, very well. We could do that, but and that comes the famous moment where you turn, and then you say, we suggest that you rather do it this way because for certain reasons this seems to us more more practical, and I have seen that your competitor has done so and so and so. So he can very definitely influence the mind by a good psychological approach and then land a sales which may be more profitable because he tries to sell him a standard item while the would-be customer wants to have some specially built equipment, which the manufacturer is well able to manufacture at a price which has to be agreed upon. You see, it's all a field by itself, and you will see, and this is the purpose why I talk about these things, how different the psychology and the whole makeup and personality of a sales engineer, former manufacturing engineer who is obsessed with producing as much of quality product as possible, and different from a development engineer who takes the work from the research man and translates it into such shapes that it can be manufactured after all. While the research engineer is just interested to get the work from the physics field into something which now can be of help and sale in the company in which he happened to work. Now, the sales engineer has some other activity. He has to have customer service. That is, his activity doesn't stop when he sells it. And he says, fine, goodbye, Joe, and that's it. You see, no, sooner or later there will be some problems. There will be some breakdown. And it may very well be that the local sales office can be able to remedy that. But it may very well be that the sales engineer is called from headquarters or is called from the specific plant if it's a very large concern which produces a specific product, and he flies it out and then with his help and advice the matter is rectified. It may also be that he does follow up and says now we have some new additional equipment which has been come out only since last year which will help you very much in this and this phase, and so there is a continued follow-up not only if something breaks down, but the man has to have continued liaison with his valuable customers. Now, there are other engineers, and I just mentioned them as a group. We have patent engineers, men who are trained in patent law, who are accredited attorneys, patent attorneys, but they have to know engineering quite well, because to help the engineers, the unhappy guy, to frame and formulate a patent or a patent claim in such a way that it goes through, that is an art in itself, and who might have some bright idea, have to go to patent engineer and he will straighten me out and either say, well, of course, this has been anticipated long ago and quotes me all the patents, or he will say, this is not even a patentable idea, a patentable process according to the patent law, you see. And if it is something which can be patentable, he will help write up the claims in the broadest terms so it covers as most as can possibly be covered, and then there comes the counter move by the patent office which will then try to narrow it down, and then there will be a continuous fight like a tennis ball game between the patent attorney of my corporation and between the patent attorneys in Washington until finally an agreement has reached, and then the thing goes through the ordinary procedure. Okay, and I don't get the patent anyway, the patent goes to my corporation. I only have the pleasure of having my name and a niece invented by Mr. So-and-so and assigned to Kaiser Aluminum. Okay. Whether they do anything with it is another question. They may have the patent, they may never use it. They may use it to prevent some competitor to do the things which we don't want to do, but we are not going to do it. So this is just patent business. Then, of course, we have administrative engineers, and I don't want to be facetious, but there must be something who makes up vacation plans and shells out the money and so on. And while this is done by certified public accountants and so on, these people must have some insight into the psychology of the people they deal with, you see. If you want to have promotion or so, there must be something in the administrative branch which can evaluate and appreciate your activities, you see. For me as a research engineer, I am pretty far away physically as well as intellectually and mentally, from an administrator who sits in his beautiful office high up, say, on the dean's floor, you see, and who has now my work in front of him and wonders whether there's a promotion financially or otherwise in order. See, he must have some engineering training, some notion of these things. So the administrative engineer is somebody who, in my opinion, is a necessary person in this business. Then there's one more which I want to mention, that's the specification writer. And he is usually used by, say, large government agencies like Bureau of Reclamation or Corps of Engineers, both government agency which have built these very large power projects on the Columbia River, on the Snake River. They sit down and write very carefully, it takes months and maybe years, specifications which may be a book, in which it is said, we want turbines which do this and this. They have this and this rating, and they must be so and so installed and so and so. So long, and their vibration characteristics, long, long engineering things. And they have to tie in with this and so on. And then there are the generators which go with these turbines. You see, now these specifications are written to great detail, and to do that, so that the purchaser knows exactly that the bidder will conform to that. This is a special field and it's a special art, special routine which you have to learn on the spot, writing specifications. And it's a question whether these specifications should spell out everything to the last detail, or whether they should be only broad outlines, things to which the equipment has to conform, and leave the details then to the people who gets the order. Now here in the Northwest, these specifications are so written that not only American companies but foreign companies can and do and did bid, and they are certain, well, I shouldn't tell you that because I take away some items of forthcoming discussion, but maybe you are not here. The government regulations are so that if a foreign bid is, say, 95% or 85% of the equivalent American bids, then they are less than the American bidders because their labor in Japan or in Austria is less, then still the award goes to an American company. But if it is less than 80%, that is, if a Japanese company quotes 75% for a turbine of the American bidders, then it has to go to the foreign bidder. So that's the law, you see. And for that reason, you will see in these power stations quite a bit foreign equipment, and there were many arguments against it. Well, if something goes wrong, how can you get parts from Austria? But of course, nowadays with jet planes, it takes 2 days. One day fly in, another day to fly out. And if there's a war, of course, when if it's an atomic war, everything goes to pot anyway. So arguments which had held 20, 30, 40 years ago simply don't hold water anymore. So specification writing, that's what I'm talking about. Specification writing is a very important and necessary art if it comes to these multi-million dollar engineering projects. It does not have anything to do for you when you go to a supermarket and buy an electric light bulb. So much about the various types of engineers. Now I want to talk about the various fields of engineers. The oldest field, unfortunately, the oldest field is military engineering. Now Leonardo da Vinci was a military engineer par excellence. Apart from being a good painter, you see, he had done quite a bit of work in developing new guns and even multiple guns, like machine guns. And the fortification of cities, all the walls, the parapets and all these things. There's very fascinating work, drawings and sketches, and his writing all in his mirror writing, you know, he wrote from the right to the left in mirror language, as kind of somewhat secret code so that every fool could read it, you see. He could read it, we can read it because we can use a mirror, you see. But he wrote it in mirror writing from right to left. And I have a very wonderful book by him in which these various fortification things are reproduced. So military engineering played a big role, and of course, unfortunately, with the big size of our defense, unquote, establishment, military engineering plays an enormous role. So it is not called that way. We call it aeronautical engineering or ballistic missile engineering. See, it is military engineering. See. And out of military engineering then, 150 years ago, civil engineering evolved as the part of the engineering fraternity which is in charge of bridges, tunnels, streets, harbors, and so on. Then we have mechanical engineering, which deals with machinery, with our automobile motor and all these things, steam locomotives, diesel locomotives. This is mechanical engineering. Mining and metallurgical engineering is an item which I don't have to mention here in Holden, where we have a mine and we have the mill, which is metallurgical, you see. And electric engineering, I don't even want to mention it because that's my field in which I've worked all my life. Now each field has enormous number of subdivisions. Electrical engineering nowadays has 180,000 members in the United States, believe it or not, 180,000 electrical engineers. They are divided into I don't know how many under groups, under sections, subsections, and each of these subsections has subsections, and then they have their meetings, and it's a very narrow climate in such group. I was at a meeting in California earlier this year in Anaheim, and there were 4,500 men, which were only concerned with underground distribution. They were not concerned with transmission and distribution. They were concerned with distribution. And they were only concerned with underground distribution, not with overhead distribution. So they were concerned with the field of which you don't see a thing here in this place. Our distribution lines here are overhead. And at some future time, if I work long enough on Warner, we may have these overhead lines taken down and put replaced by underground cables. And I went so far that I saw to it that he gets a quotation for such cables, but it is not yet done. So this only shows how far these fields are subdivided. And in addition to these old standard fields, civil and military, mechanical, mining and metallurgical, and electrical, which were the basic original engineering divisions, we have now innumerable other divisions, aeronautical, space, and also such as welding and heating and refrigeration, which are then highly specialized, you see. And finally, last but not least, there is a mechanics extant to produce certified professional engineers. In order to become a professional engineer which is licensed by the state and which may have a seal and may affix the seal to blueprints which he submits to the government, not to Holden Village, but to such people who insist that these plans are submitted by professional engineers, there's a procedure to become a professional engineer. You have to be a graduate engineer. You have to work so and so many years as practicing engineer, not necessarily as your own, but you can be employed by a company. And then you have to go through a written examination in which a number of questions are asked which you have to answer, and there are always training courses in every larger place, even in Spokane, which are in preparations for the professional engineers examination. And if you have done this examination, then you get your license and you pay then what, $5 a year to keep your license. The funny part was that when I came to this country and I was anxious to become a professional engineer, I had my doctor's of engineering degree in Germany. So I came to this country, and of course I filled that all out and gave them my very good German training and German activities. I had worked with the government in Germany for over 10 years and with industry in Germany too. So I had quite a good background. So I went to one of these refresher courses, one of these climbing courses, and I was all prepared to calculate strengths of the roof and the stresses on bridges, things with which I am professionally not the slightest bit concerned as an electric engineer, but things which you have to know for this professional engineer's examination. So I went into this professional engineer's examination and I tell you what I had to do. They were only interested in my proficiency in English. So I had to write at least 500 word discussion in English on a number of subjects which were given to me. Now, one subject which I chose was apparel. And inasmuch as this was just a test of my knowledge of English language, I considered this as a tremendous joke. And I wrote as follows. I said, apparel is an enormous subject, and I don't quite know how to start with it. Of course, As a German, being very systematic and very pedantic, we can take the historical view. I can start with Adam and Eve and go into discussion of the fig leaves. And from the fig leaves, I will then proceed to the latest number of Life, which showed the very latest fashion in Paris, you see. So I was kidding all along, you see. And then I said, it is of course possible to take a technological approach, and we can discuss the suits, the asbestos suits of firefighters, and we can discuss the equipment of scuba divers. But I am afraid that I've already chatted for 500 words, so I close now. Goodbye. And a few weeks later, it was announced that I had passed myself. I'm a professional engineer now.